This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
It's the largest newspaper in America and a trusted source for international business topics for over 100 years. Join us now for the Wall Street Journal on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is the Wall Street Journal, and I'm your reader, Michelle, with the audio reading service at Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from the Wall Street Journal, copyright 2025, Dow Jones & Company, Inc., beginning with September 25th through October 1st. Starting with The Mystery of Mamadou, a Delivery Guy Who Became a Superhero, by Julia Munslow. Whispers of a seemingly superhuman delivery courier began spreading this summer. People said he is the hardest working man in New York City, that he delivers your food faster than anyone, that his orders always arrive at the exact requested location before he disappears into the wind, leaving behind only a bag of piping hot food. They claim he is everywhere and nowhere at once. He is the man who alone shoulders the burden of keeping the city running. And he doesn't just deliver food, he delivers babies, too. His name is Mamadou. Dozens of New Yorkers have posted videos and screenshots posting that Mamadou has delivered their food and wondering how one man manages to do it all. They express their love and appreciation, sometimes with songs. "He is the hero of our town," said Jake Schroeder, a 23-year-old Brooklynite. "It's giving the Michael Phelps of food delivery. He is what Kelly Clarkson was to American Idol. I waited at the window for him with Claire Thomas Allen, a 28-year-old in Manhattan's Upper West Side. He should be the president," said Ben Weiss, a 24-year-old in Flatiron District. "Just one problem. Mamadou may not exist, at least not as one man." The first mentions of Mamadou emerged in early 2025, when Derek Yen, a 24-year-old manager at tech company Alchemy, noticed a strange trend in his food orders. "Is there a reason every food delivery driver in New York is named Mamadou? Either that or my boy putting in overtime," Yen joked in a post on X. As the summer unfolded, the myth of Mamadou grew. More New Yorkers began posting videos or photos celebrating Mamadou. Google Trends show searches for Mamadou in New York peaked in August. Schrader, a comedian, felt so inspired he penned a song. "Mamadou, how do you do every delivery in lightning speed? Mamadou, who are you? And what is your name, Lightning McQueen?" "The toast of New York City, the tea of delivery," he crooned. Schrader once tried to express his appreciation in person, though he thinks it got lost in translation. "I had ordered Thai food, and a man named Mamadou delivered it to me, and I was like, 'Thank you so much, I wrote a song about you,'" Schrader said. He did not want to engage. He was like, "What? Have a nice day." Mamadou is a common name in West Africa. It's a variation of Muhammad, and many men are called named Mamadou in reference to the Islamic prophet, including multiple couriers in New York. Most New Yorkers are in on the joke. They know there isn't just one Mamadou, but revel in building up larger-than-life internet legend who has created a sense of camaraderie and community. The Wall Street Journal spoke with several couriers named Mamadou in New York, who said they're both delighted and perplexed by their sudden celebrity. Mamadou Diallo, 32, recalled one excited customer stopping him and asking if he was the famous delivery Mamadou. Diallo, who's a doctor in his home country of Guinea, delivers part-time while he studies to practice medicine in the U.S., and said he and other couriers named Mamadou laugh about it. "Mamadou has become a star. He's a famous person," they say in French. Multiple Mamadous said customers have gotten more generous since the name took off. One received an $86 tip. "All the Mamadous I know are hardworking, and they work honestly," said Mamadou, a 32-year-old courier in New York. "If you want to do something, I do it with my heart." But they've paid a price. Mamadou say they've been the target of excitable amateur paparazzi and overeager customers. "People sometimes, they take pictures of me," this This is Mamadou, said Sai. He doesn't mind, but knows others who don't like it. If Mamadou is a superhero, one of his superpowers is that he can turn a bad day around. As one does, I was having a crash out one over nothing, said Alan, the Upper West Sider. I decided I really wanted cheesecake, and it wasn't even worth the walk to the bodega. So I ordered it, and his name popped up, and I was like, this is the best. I literally felt like a kid when you have the Santa tracker on your phone and you're looking for Santa, said Alan, a social media manager. I was sitting at my window waiting for this man to pull up on his bike. It's a tough gig, requiring long hours and physical stamina. Some Mamadous are glad to feel appreciated. People say, thank you for working in the rain, in the snow, in the sun to deliver our food, Mamadou Silas, 21, said in French. Yen, who had helped launch the Mamadou legend, is a former DoorDash delivery driver. He understands the grit it can take and hopes the buzz boosts broader appreciation. I started DoorDash because I had 79 cents in my bank account and needed to pay some bills for my mom, Yen said. I always want to support people like Mamadou, whether 100 people or one person. How Zelensky's Charm Offensive Reversed Trump's Skepticism on Ukraine, by James Marson. Kyiv, Ukraine. A half year ago in the Oval Office, President Trump told Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that you don't have the cards in the war with Russia. On Tuesday with the United Nations, Trump lauded the performance of Ukraine's army and poured scorn on Russia's military efforts. I think Ukraine, with the support of the European Union, is in a position to fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form, Trump said on Truth Social after meeting with Zelensky. Why not? U.S. officials said that Trump issued this statement in part to pressure Russian President Vladimir Putin to make a deal since no real progress toward ending the war had been made since last month's meeting with Trump and Putin in Alaska. The sharp verbal shift for Trump came amid Russia's continued failure to make significant gains on the battlefield, a slowdown in the Russian economy, and a concerted effort by Zelensky to woo the U.S. president. Trump has spent recent days with U.S. officials who have long pushed for a stronger stance toward Ukraine as he prepared for the meeting with Zelensky, including Ukraine envoy Keith Kellogg and new ambassador to the U.N. Mike Waltz. They updated Trump on current battlefield conditions, according to two people familiar with the situation, noting that Russia has made little progress in recent years. Trump was also made aware of planned Ukrainian offensive, which would require U.S. intelligence support, the people said. Officials said that Trump only made a rhetorical shift, but not a policy shift. He is still authorizing weapons sales to Ukraine, but restricting the use of American-made weapons to attack within sovereign Russian territory. Zelensky showed on Tuesday that he has learned from the disastrous meeting with Trump in February. He has smartened up his attire after criticism from Trump supporters and, seated next to the U.S. president, head of the Tuesday meeting, repeatedly thanked him for his support, praising his efforts to end the war while talking up the performance of the Ukrainian army on the battlefield. Trump, Zelensky said later, clearly understands the situation and is well informed about aspects of this war. It's far from certain that Trump's shift in tone will be reflected in change in policy. He has so far proved unwilling to impose significant sanctions on Russia, despite making threats to do so or provide the kind of surge of weapons that Ukraine would need to retake significant territory and protect its cities from Russian aerial bombardments. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said Wednesday that Zelensky's view was currently dominant with Trump, but that Russia would have opportunities to convey its position to the White House. Secretary of State Marco Rubio met Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov on Wednesday morning. Speaking to the UN General Assembly on Wednesday, Zelensky didn't comment on Trump's apparent lack of tact, saying only that he had a good meeting with the U.S. president. He urged representatives of member nations to condemn Russia as it keeps dragging this war on. He also warned that if left unchecked, Moscow would aim to widen its ambitions in Europe. Ukraine is only the first, and now Russian drones are already flying across Europe, and Russian operations are already spreading across countries. Zelensky pointed in particular to Moldova, which he said was being targeted by a campaign of Russian interference. In Ukraine, some welcomed Trump's comments with cautious optimism. Andrei Yermak, the chief of staff to Zelensky, posted an emoji of a bicep alongside a screenshot of a White House social media post calling the Ukrainian's president a brave man. But opposition lawmaker Yaroslav Zelenok said on social media that Trump's words don't mean anything and wouldn't have any consequences. Still, the U.S. president's apparent reappraisal of Ukraine's chances in the war also came with a commitment to continue providing weapons to European members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, who then passed them on to Ukraine to use against Russia. Zelensky's rehabilitation is all the more surprising given the mauling he took in the Oval Office in February. The meeting was supposed to clear the air after Zelensky said he was worried that the U.S. president was adopting Kremlin talking points. Trump fired back that Zelensky was a dictator without elections. But the meeting descended into acrimony when Vice President J.D. Vance accused Zelensky of being ungrateful for American help. After Zelensky sought to defend himself against Vance and Trump, Trump's team evicted the Ukrainian delegation from the White House. Zelensky sought to patch up relations by expressing regret in a letter and quickly agreeing to a U.S. proposal for a ceasefire while Russia demurred. As Trump pushed for a quick peace deal, Zelensky trod a fine line between backing the U.S. president's aims while pushing back on ideas that would be unacceptable to Ukrainians, such as formally ceding territory to Russia. A meeting at the funeral of Pope Francis appeared to heal the rift and boost Zelensky's standing. The two men met privately for 15 minutes in St. Peter's Basilica in what Trump later called a beautiful meeting. Afterward, Trump offered rare criticism of Putin. When Zelensky returned to the White House in August, he wore a black suit-style jacket. His military-style attire at the February meeting had sparked a testy exchange with pro-Trump reporter. Trump praised his new look, and the August meeting was more cordial, with the U.S. leader proposing a peace conference with Putin. By Tuesday, Trump had adopted some of Zelensky's talking points. He mocked Russia's army for its slow progress against a much smaller nation and praised Ukrainian troops. "We have great respect for the fight that the Ukraine is putting up," he said. "It's pretty amazing, actually." Trump also disparaged Russia's economy, saying it's terrible right now. And when Zelensky praised Trump's initiative to press foreign European allies to stop buying Russian oil, he indicated he would lean on Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, referring to him as a friend. Trump said that while he hadn't spoken with Orban yet, he felt the Hungarian leader would change his mind if he did. "And I think I'll be doing that," Trump said. Now, from September 26th, James Comey indicted on false statement charges. Charges follow Trump's ouster of DOJ prosecutor who fought insufficient evidence for case ex-FBI director asserts innocence. By Sadie Gurman and Lydia Wheeler. Dateline Alexandria, Virginia. A federal grand jury in Virginia indicted former FBI Director James Comey on Thursday on charges of making false statements and obstruction days after President Trump demanded the prosecution and ousted the U.S. attorney, who determined there was insufficient evidence to bring the case. Comey had been under investigation for what prosecutors said were lies he told in 2020 congressional testimony during a hearing about the Bureau's earlier investigation of the Trump's campaign ties to Russia in the 2016 election. Prosecutors had raced to obtain the indictment, as the statute of limitations on such a case was due to run out next week. "Justice in America," Trump posted on social media after the indictment. "He has been so bad for our country for so long, and now is the beginning of being held responsible for his crimes against our nation." In a video posted on Instagram, Comey said, "My family and I have known for years that there are costs to standing up to Donald Trump." He added, "My heart is broken for the Department of Justice, but I have great confidence in the federal judicial system. I am innocent, so let's have a trial." An arraignment was scheduled for October 9th, according to court records. Democrats criticized the case as an abuse of power. Donald Trump has made clear that he intends to turn our justice system into a weapon for punishing and silencing his critics, said Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. Our system depends on prosecutors making decisions based on evidence in the law, not on personal grudges of a politician determined to settle scores. The charges come after Trump publicly questioned why the Justice Department hadn't brought cases against several of his key adversaries, including Comey, and he called on his Attorney General Pam Bondi to act quickly. Last Friday, the president ousted U.S. attorney he had appointed earlier this year in the Eastern District of Virginia, Eric Siebert, who told colleagues he didn't see a case to bring against Comey, then named one of his former personal lawyers, Lindy Halligan, in his place. The charges as alleged in this case represent a breach of the public trust at an extraordinary level, said Halligan, who presented the case herself and was the only prosecutor to sign the indictment. Halligan, who was in court when the indictment was handed up late Thursday, pursued the case over objections from other departments, others who expressed doubts. The indictment sent shockwaves through the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alexandria and touched off the resignation of at least one career prosecutor, a relative of Comey's who works in the office and had spent hours in court awaiting the outcome. In a letter to Halligan, the prosecutor Troy Edwards Jr., who was deputy chief of the office's national security section, said he was resigning to hold up my oath to the Constitution and country. The indictment said Comey lied when he testified that he had not authorized someone else at the FBI to be an anonymous source in news reports. During the September 30, 2020 hearing, Senator Ted Cruz, Republican, Texas, asked Comey about a 2016 episode in which Andrew McCabe, Comey's former deputy, had helped provide information to the Wall Street Journal about an FBI investigation into the Clinton Foundation. Mr. McCabe, who works for you, has publicly and repeatedly stated that he leaked information to the Wall Street Journal and that you were directly aware of it, and that you directly authorized it, Cruz said, according to a transcript of the hearing. Comey, who had previously said he never authorized media leaks about the Trump or Clinton investigations, said he stood by his earlier testimony. Prosecutors in Trump's first term also investigated McCabe in connection to the episode, but ultimately didn't charge him with any crimes. In the new indictment, Halligan had sought a third count against Comey over other statements Comey made in the hearing about intelligence from 2016 related to Clinton and Trump. The grand jury didn't agree to indict on that count. The new prosecution is a major escalation of Trump's efforts to seek retribution against his perceived enemies. Comey oversaw the initial 2016 investigation into Trump's campaign ties to Russia that dogged much of the president's first term. Trump fired Comey in May 2017, leading to the appointment of a special counsel who pursued the investigation. Trump has long viewed Comey, a Republican who was appointed by the FBI by President Barack Obama, as a nemesis. He has urged aides to find ways to extract payback, vastly stretching the bounds of what prosecutors traditionally consider when charging people with crimes. Trump had pushed Bondi repeatedly in private in recent days to bring charges against Comey, even as she has expressed skepticism about the case, people familiar with discussion said. We can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility, Trump wrote in a weekend social media post addressed to Pam. Trump has quickly taken control of the Justice Department, installing loyalists who have ousted employees that worked on the investigations into Trump, abandoned investigations of Trump allies, and pursued those of Trump's political foes. Moving on to September 27th, former financier Howard Rubin charged with sex trafficking. The one-time portfolio manager of the Soros Fund is accused of assaulting women he paid for sex, by James Finelli. Former financier Howard Rubin was charged Friday with trafficking dozens of women whom federal prosecutors said he had sexually and physically assaulted during encounters in a Central Park penthouse with a sex dungeon. A 13-page indictment said Rubin, 70 years old, recruited ex-Playboy models and other women for paid sex and during the sessions tied them up, drugged them, and beat them without their consent. Rubin forced the alleged victims to sign nondisclosure agreements and threatened legal actions if they sued him, according to prosecutors. He also hired private detectives to investigate the women, they said. Rubin, whose Wall Street exploits were chronicled in the Michael Lewis book Liar's Poker, was arrested Friday morning at his Fairfield, Connecticut home. His career in finance spanned more than three decades and included stints at Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, and Soros Fund Management, a firm that oversees money for George Soros' family and his philanthropic foundation. Rubin faces 10 criminal counts, including sex trafficking, transportation to engage in prostitution, and bank fraud, according to the indictment brought by the Brooklyn U.S. Attorney's Office. He pleaded not guilty at his arraignment in federal court Friday. A judge ordered him detained. Lawyers for Rubin didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. His former personal assistant, Jennifer Powers, was charged with arranging the sexual encounters and helping silence the alleged victims. She was arrested in Texas and was expected to appear in Brooklyn federal court at a later date. Lawyers for Powers didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Prosecutors said Rubin trafficked women from 2009 to 2019, often misleading them about what the encounters would entail. Many of the sex sessions occurred in luxury hotels in New York, they said, but later Rubin rented a penthouse apartment and turned one of the bedrooms into a sex dungeon. The room was outfitted with bondage equipment and restraining straps, according to prosecutors. The walls were painted red and soundproof, they said. Powers, who helped to furnish the dungeon, described in an email to Rubin how she put chains and a cross and a bed in the room, prosecutors said. Rubin preyed on vulnerable women who had previously been sexually abused or faced financial hardship, according to prosecutors. He texted an unnamed co-conspirator that one victim hated the encounters, but she needed the money, they said. Rubin also provided victims a safe word to stop the sex if it became too violent, prosecutors said. However, when the victims used the word, Rubin would continue without their consent, they said. Sometimes the women were beaten so badly they lost consciousness, they said. The women were typically paid $5,000 for sex, but Rubin sometimes underpaid them if he was dissatisfied with the performance, prosecutors said. At times, the women would complain to Powers, Rubin's assistant, about the violence, according to the indictment. She would play down the encounters, prosecutors said, telling the victims to ice their injuries or put cream on their bruises. She would also blame the women for allowing Rubin to get too drunk, prosecutors said. The alleged victims were required to sign nondisclosure agreements that included language that the women assumed the risks of injuries during the sexual encounters. Blank nondisclosure agreements were found in a safe in the penthouse, prosecutors said. Some of Rubin's accusers previously sued him over the alleged abuse. A jury awarded plaintiffs nearly $4 million in 2022. Rubin has appealed the judgment. New York City office shooter had CTE, medical examiner finds. Shane Tamura was diagnosed postmortem with the brain disease associated with head injuries and often found in football players. By Jack Morfitt. An autopsy found the shooter who killed four people at a Midtown Manhattan office building had chronic traumatic encephalopathy, commonly known as CTE, a brain disease associated with head injuries and often found in former football players. Shane Tamura's brain tissue was found to have unambiguous diagnostic evidence of CTE, according to the New York City Chief of Medical Examiner. Tamura, 27 years old, appeared to be targeting the National Football League at its 345 Park Avenue headquarters during the July 28th shooting. Tamura left a suicide note on which he pleaded, "Study my brain, please," and went on to accuse the NFL of concealing the dangers of the sport on players' brains. The findings correspond with the classification of low-stage CTE according to current consensus criteria, the medical examiner's office said Friday. Tamura's actions and a suicide note put the spotlight on CTE, which has become a significant concern in contact sports like football. The disease, which stems from repeated head trauma, has been found by researchers in the brain of scores of former football players. The symptoms, according to the Boston University CTE Center, can include impulse control problems, dementia, and memory loss. As a high schooler, Tamura was a gifted running back who played football at Granada Hills Charter School in Los Angeles. Tamura killed four before turning the gun on himself, according to authorities. Among the four slain victims were an executive from a financial firm, Blackstone, and New York City police officer. An NFL executive who was shot in the lobby of the Park Tower survived his wounds. In a statement, the NFL pointed to the medical examiner's claim that the science around CTE continues to evolve, and the physical and mental symptoms are still being studied. There is no justification for the horrific acts that took place, an NFL spokesperson said. Tamura had documented history of mental illness, and Las Vegas police performed mental health crisis interventions in 2022 and 2024. According to a 9/11 call from September 2022, Tamura's mother told a Las Vegas police dispatcher that her son had a handgun, a history of concussions, and wanted to end his life. He's under doctor's care for depression, concussion, like sports concussions, chronic migraines, and insomnia, Tamura's mother said. During a search of Tamura's Las Vegas home following the shooting, New York NYPD detectives found medication prescribed to him for the treatment of psychosis, epilepsy, and inflammation. Four killed after man rams into Michigan church and starts shooting. Police say they believe the gunman also set the church on fire. He died in parking lot. By Tally Urbell. Grand Blanc, Michigan. A shooter left four people dead and several people injured at a church about 50 miles north of Detroit on Sunday, police said. Hundreds of people were at a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints service when a man drove through the front doors, got out of the vehicle, and began firing with a rifle at 10:25 a.m. local time in Grand Blanc, Michigan, said the township police chief, William Renya. Photos from the scene showed a silver truck flying two American flags that had rammed into the church. Law enforcement officials said they believe the gunman also set the church on fire, using gasoline as an accelerant. Police said a call came in at 10:25 and 32 seconds. Officers were on the scene at 10:25 a.m. and 57 seconds. The suspect was neutralized at 10:33 a.m. in the parking lot by the Department of Natural Resources officer and a Grand Blanc Township officer. The suspect who died is Thomas Jacob Sanford, 40 years old, from nearby city of Burton, Michigan, police said. A Marine Corps spokesman said Sanford served from 2004 to 2008, deploying to Iraq in 2007 and 2008, and had the rank of sergeant. He had long-standing ties to the area and, according to public records, was married to a woman named Tella. They had a young son. Two people died from gunshot wounds. Eight people remained hospitalized with gunshot injuries as of early evening, Renya said. Seven people were in stable condition and one was in critical condition. Law enforcement officers didn't release the names of the victims. First responders discovered two additional bodies in the church, Renya later said. They were still clearing the building, he said, and he didn't know how many people remained unaccounted for. The authorities located some suspected explosive devices, said Thomas Dyer, the special agent for the region, from alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosives, but it wasn't clear if they were used to start the fire. Expert investigators from the agency are coming to investigate the scene and determine the fire's cause, he said. In the aftermath of the shooting Sunday, police and fire trucks blocked off the road to the church at a busy intersection in Grand Blanc, a helicopter whirled above. Across the highway, the authorities closed an IMAX movie theater so it could serve as a gathering place for people seeking information about their family members. Ashley Duffy, a 33-year-old human resources executive from Grand Blanc, stood in nearby Buffalo Wild Wings parking lot to view what she could of the scene. Duffy said nothing like it had happened in Grand Blanc in her decade living there. She worries about an escalating cycle of violence. The country is very scary right now in general. Usually when stuff happens like this, the more people get crazy, and who knows what's going to happen, she said. Federal Bureau of Investigation official Reuben Coleman said the agency was leading the investigation and was committed to finding the motive behind the tragedy. Law enforcement said it would investigate the suspect's home and cell phone records. After Sanford was killed, there were bomb threats made to churches and other locations, said Michigan State Police spokesman Ken Vetter. The authorities searched and cleared the locations, she said. Politicians across the political spectrum condemned the shooting at the church. President Trump said in a social media post that this appeared to be yet another targeted attack on Christians and called for an end to an epidemic of violence in the U.S. The Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints asked for cooperation with local authorities and thanked people for their concern and prayers. Places of worship are meant to be sanctuaries of peacemaking, prayer, and connection, the church said. Trump administration opens new front to strip Harvard of federal funding. The government is starting a process that could deliver the biggest financial blow yet to the university in its fight with the White House, by Natalie Andrews. The Trump administration is escalating its fight with Harvard University by starting a process that could make the nation's oldest and wealthiest university ineligible for federal grants over allegations of anti-Semitism on campus. In a letter addressed to Harvard President Alan Garber on Monday, the Office for Civil Rights in the Health and Human Services Department said it is referring the university to a process called debarment. The move could deliver the biggest financial blow yet to Harvard during its fight with the Trump administration, putting billions of dollars in jeopardy. Earlier this month, a Boston federal judge ruled that the government had to restore $2.2 billion in research funding to Harvard that the government froze earlier this year. Debarment, which essentially would declare the university ineligible to do business with the government, is another way the White House can seek to cut funds off. A Harvard spokesman didn't have an immediate comment. In the past, the university has said it has taken steps to address anti-Semitism on campus, and the government attacks are a violation of the school's First Amendment rights. The moves come as negotiations between Harvard and the White House have reached an impasse in the wake of the judge's ruling on September 3rd that the government had improperly cut off the research funding, including to people familiar with discussions. Debarment is designed for entities deemed not responsible enough to do business with the government, an administrative official said. The White House doesn't believe that Harvard has sufficiently addressed anti-Semitism on campus, the person said. The path to possible debarring involves several steps, and it isn't a given that Harvard will ultimately be debarred. First, the administration is recommending that HHS suspend all federal grant funds, which would block federal grant funds from any federal agency from going to Harvard. A suspension would last a year, and during that time, the government would review whether Harvard should be permanently banned from receiving federal grant money, an administration official said. Harvard has 20 days from the notice to request a hearing. Harvard and the Trump administration have been in talks to resolve months of the government's pressure tactics over what it says are anti-Semitism and diversity-related concerns. President Trump has said he wants no less than $500 million from Harvard. Now, moving on to September 29. A barbecue's dynasty's feud is rocking a Texas town. A rift inside a royal family of smoked meat has developed into public jabs, property damage, litigation, and dueling restaurants, by Jennifer Williams. Dateline Lockhart, Texas. This town is a barbecue mecca, drawing people from around the state and beyond who are united by their love of smoked meat. But these days, the pride of this town, about 30 miles south of Austin, is also a source of deepening division. One of the area's most prominent meat-smoking families is locked in a years-long feud that has devolved into public jabs, property damage, litigation, and dueling restaurants. The rift has spilled outside the family, with barbecue fans picking sides in a fight nobody really understands. This particular brouhaha comes up quite a bit, said Rob Wilmore, a 56-year-old tech worker in Austin, It's like a barbecue soap opera. Lockhart, home to about 17,000 people, has 7 barbecue restaurants. People travel long distances to taste brisket, sausage, and other fare in what the state legislature declares its barbecue capital. The Black family has sold barbecue in Lockhart since the early 1930s. Brothers Terry and Kent Black, whose grandfather started the enterprise, helped over the years. Terry managed the books from an accounting office across the street. Kent, a lawyer, oversaw operations, cleaned tables, and cut meat, among other tasks, before rejoining the business full-time in 2008. What happened next is a part of Lockhart lore. Some diners speculate a dispute over the method of smoking meat caused the divorce. Others think Kent and his brother disagreed on the future of the business. Kent said his parents were ready to retire and thinking about succession when they asked him to return. "I had no intention of some hostile takeover," he said. Terry's son Mike said his uncle wanted to run the business without input from his brother's side. Whatever the reason, some 5 years after Kent's return, a fax was sent to Terry's office alerting him of a family meeting. After the gathering, Terry and the rest of the clan involved with the business were out. Kent bought the company and now runs it. "No single fax or meeting led to the ouster," Kent said. "It was a decision his parents made in consultation with family members and advisors over years." Terry's crew had no plans to stop smoking meat under the family name. They hatched a plan to open a business in Austin named Black's Barbecue. The original Black sent a cease and desist order, blocking the move. Soon after, Terry Black's was born. A second outpost opened in Dallas in 2019, then came Lockhart in 2022. "We wanted to compete with Black's," said Mike, "but I'd expect they'd take a shot." After plans for Lockhart became public, according to Mike, a billboard on land Terry owned was cut to the ground, prompting a lawsuit against Kent that was later settled. The fight was just getting started. Terry Black's is the first barbecue spot many encounter when they drive into town, so Black's erected a sign down the road that visitors would see before Terry's namesake place. Only one original Black's barbecue in Lockhart. When the Labor Department cited Black's Barbecue for withholding $230,353 in tips from employees, Terry's side saw an opportunity. A message on the marquee in the parking lot went up. Another 230,353 reasons why you should eat at Terry Black's Barbecue. "That was a nice little shot at him," Mike said, referring to his uncle. "I thought it drummed up pretty good publicity. It pissed him off. So I checked multiple boxes for us." Kent said Black's has a responsibility to ensure workers' tips are protected and its policies follow the law. Black's diners looking out across the street may notice another sign in front of the corporate office for Terry's Empire, not affiliated with the location across the street. Those who miss the signs may find out about the dispute on social media or Reddit, or hear chatter around Lockhart. Before stepping foot in Terry Black's, a would-be diner might hear from one of the people smoking meats about the difference between the two restaurants. A sign at the door prompted a documentary on the feud. Barbecue fans with an affinity for an underdog have loyalty to Terry Black's because of the faction's ouster. Fans of Black's are drawn in by its history in the town. Crystal Rios recognizes the high stakes of her allegiance. "When I learned of the story, it was like, oh wow, it's that serious," the San Antonian who works in education policy said. But Rios, 45, insists it doesn't factor into her view that Terry Black's, with its outstanding outdoor seating, brisket and potato salad, is the best. David Corley, a 32-year-old tech worker in Austin, makes the trek to Terry Black's in Lockhart 2 to 3 times a year. The food, environment, and location matter, of course, but so do the rumors. Corley initially preferred Black's because it was the original, and he liked the small-town feel with rows of picnic-style tables and deer antlers and steer horns on the walls. That changed after he saw speculation online that Black's puts less care into its size than Terry Black's. "Reading about it definitely colored my opinion," Corley said. "Then I also kind of confirmed it with my palate." Barbecue borders on religion in Texas, Kent said, so debates are inevitable. Still, he is ready to move from this one and hopes for reconciliation. The way I see it, there is no feud, he said. We won't actively try to pick a fight with them. Mike said he has no plans to let the quabble die. As long as he's alive and his son is alive, they're running Black's Barbecue, and we're running Terry's Black's Barbecue. There will always be competition, he said. This little feud will stay alive forever. Was it really a concert if there was no special guest? In a world of sky-high ticket prices, surprise celebrity appearances have become essential. By Elias Light. Devoted music fans are shelling out around $300 a month on concert tickets. They're eager to see their favorite star live, and increasingly they're also banking on seeing a celebrity guest grace the stage for a song or two. Robert Smith from The Cure singing with Olivia Rodrigo, or the actress Margaret Qualley jumping up to join Sabrina Carpenter. Fans have started to expect that, says Julio Jimede, Shakira's production designer. On Reddit, they share wish lists of artists they hope will make cameos during Bad Bunny's residency. Mark Anthony doing Preciosa would tear the roof off, or warn each other not to get their hopes up. They speculate about who The Weeknd might bring out in Atlanta. Outkast, A Man Can Dream. How about Charlie XCX at Glastonbury? Surprise celebrity pop-ups can help concertgoers feel like they enjoyed a unique experience and ensure that clips from the show commandeer more eyeballs on social media. But for artists, getting the right guests can be challenging logistically. Famous people are inherently tough to pin down, and thematically. The audiences are quick to determine if it feels contrived, says Nate Sokolowski, vice president at Wasserman Music, a booking agency that works with Kendrick Lamar, Coldplay, and Chapel Roan. Live music executives trace the recent celebrity guest bonanza back to Coachella, the long-running music festival founded in 1999, where stars have made a habit of orchestrating the sort of eye-popping moments that trigger fan delirium, and you should have been there headlines. Rihanna joined Calvin Harris on stage in 2012, Madonna joined Drake in 2015, and NSYNC joined Ariana Grande in 2019. The practice has spread outside of festivals. There's even more incentive to mastermind these moments today, since concerts now enjoy an extended second life on a short-form video platforms. Everybody's trying to find the virility, says Ethan Eshek, who manages the rising pop group Marius and the soul singer Leon Bridges. A well-chosen surprise guest will spark energy online, and that energy on TikTok and Instagram will ultimately make its way back to the streaming services. Most artists chose to bring out collaborators they have already recorded with. Shakira's ongoing stadium tour has benefited from a steady drip of guests, including Ozuna, a Puerto Rican singer with deep resume of bright, bouncy hits, and Alejandro Sanz, a Spanish star who excels at husky ballads. Both have appeared on Shakira songs, so it's clear to fans why they are there, and their appearance slots easily into the flow of the performance. Another version of this strategy includes bringing out an artistic giant from a previous generation, a way of paying tribute while they're showing off good taste. This summer, Rodrigo has been joined on stage by Weezer and David Byrne, while Zach Bryan scored a Bruce Springsteen cameo. Earth, Wind & Fire popped up during Carpenter's Lollapalooza set to perform a pair of dance floor records, Let's Groove and September. Although some of these surprises can be planned in advance, they can also be difficult to orchestrate. A whirlwind of last-minute logistical complications, Earth, Wind & Fire's appearance was literally done in a day, says Marlene Tucci, co-head of international touring at CAA, who works with Carpenter. They were playing in Detroit. It involved, on the Saturday, getting them on a plane to Chicago, getting them hotels. They rehearsed that Sunday morning and played that night. As guest appearances by musical collaborators have become more common, some artists have ventured further afield to add oomph to their shows, recruiting Hollywood luminaries to join them on stage. Famous actors can rev up a crowd just with their presence, and they don't need to rehearse or perform. It's fun to see people of that caliber in an environment where you would normally see them, said Himede, who was at Bad Bunny's show in August when Penelope Cruz introduced the star's song Voya Lavarte, PR. You would usually see Penelope Cruz at cons. The folk pop singer role model has made a especially savvy use of actor guest appearances, enlisting Natalie Portman and Kate Hudson to dance around on separate occasions as he performed his most popular single, Sally When the Wine Runs Out, which has more than 120 million streams on Spotify. The stunt started a performance in Dallas where the comedian Jake Shane, a friend of role models, acted out the Sally character, riffing on a rumor that Shane had inspired the song. The segment subsequently became a regular part of Role Model's show, with both fans and celebrities taking part. You're really seeing a lot of excitement and fervor around who could Sally be, says Sokolsky, who is one of Role Model's agents. Other artists are trying to devise their own compelling surprises. I'm in these conversations on almost a weekly basis where it's like, what person represents New York City? What person represents Tokyo? We should bring that person up, says Alexander Wesley, a creative director with show designer who has worked with Weekend and Swedish House Mafia. It's fun, and now everybody expects it, adds Tushy. If you don't have special guests, they're like, oh, really? They're disappointed. Now on to September 30th. This windowless plane is vying to be the private jet of the future. Flexjet to buy 300 business planes from Auto Aerospace by Owen Tucker Smith. The Phantom 3500 aircraft by Auto in hangar in Bentonville, Arkansas. Auto Aerospace's new business jet has no traditional passenger windows and a teardrop-shaped cabin. Private jet company Flexjet wants hundreds of them. The company said Monday that Flexjet signed a contract to buy 300 of Auto's Phantom 3500 aircraft. Flexjet's order would be worth approximately $5.85 billion based on market pricing for each jet, though the companies declined to comment on the negotiated value of their deal. Flexjet will be Auto's first fleet customer. The aircraft is in development with its first flight targeted for 2027. Auto's Phantom 3500, which seats 9 passengers, is lined with digital panes that display a virtual view of the outdoors, a feature that Chief Executive Paul Toe calls supernatural vision. Toe said that the plane's design helps cut fuel burn by 60% compared with other jets of similar size. That could help make private flights cheaper over time than seats in airlines business class, he added. The plane's virtual windows are powered by high-resolution cameras fixed to the outside of the aircraft. The lack of windows makes for a lighter aircraft, Otto said, and the smoother exterior allows the plane to be more aerodynamic. The company said the digital displays inside the cabin will be 6 feet wide and provide a color-enhanced panoramic view of what's around the jet. You no longer have to lean over and look out the window, he said. You could sit in our seat and look at the entire world around you. It's surreal. The company said the digitized windows will be compelling to customers, especially Gen Z travelers who are more technologically savvy. Ohio-based Flexjet leases and sells fractional ownership of private jets to individuals and Fortune 500 companies. It's been looking to build out its fleet as more wealthy Americans look to fly private. Flexjet is fresh off an $800 million investment led by private equity firm L. Catterton, which has catered to luxury clientele with invite-only Napa Valley wine tastings and philanthropic events. It has a fleet of roughly 340 jets and is valued above $4 billion. Auto has so far raised $250 million in fundraising from private investors. It is building the Phantom 3500 in Jacksonville, Florida, with the help of $515 million incentive package from the state. Auto is targeting delivery by 2030. The company built its first full-size mock-up of the plane recently for an industry conference. The cabin is 22 feet long and 7.5 feet wide. Toe said that since the model requires less fuel storage, the aircraft can be smaller, reducing manufacturing costs. Otto aims to use revenue from sales of the Phantom jet to build a larger regional aircraft with similar aerodynamic design, the Otto CEO said. Meanwhile, he is focused on the business jet market, which will be valued at $43 billion a year. And moving on to October 1st, how to set up ChatGPT's new parental controls. This guide to OpenAI's feature launching Monday will walk you through steps you can use to make your child's account safer by Julie Jargon. In an effort to safeguard ChatGPT experience for teens, OpenAI is offering parental controls. The new feature will start rolling out to all ChatGPT users on Monday. Parents must have their own ChatGPT accounts to use the controls. In addition to the new parental controls detailed below, parents will receive emergency notifications in some cases where their teens or adult children who agree to link accounts ask ChatGPT about suicide or self-harm. The prompts will be reviewed by a worker before a notification goes to parents via a chosen means, such as text or email. OpenAI will provide the time of day and other relevant context, but not the transcription of the text. The updates come after a California family last month sued the company over concerns that their teenage son's suicide was related to troubling conversations with ChatGPT. There have also been many reported instances of people experiencing delusions and psychosis, including one that ended in a murder-suicide after engaging with the chatbot. OpenAI has said it will update its model to better support people during times of mental illness. The new parental controls can be used by families with dependents of any age, though kids are supposed to be 13 or older to use the app. Parents can invite their kids to link accounts, or teens can invite their parents. Unlike some other platform settings, these stay active until they are turned off, regardless of how old the dependent is. It's not age-gated. You can invite your 35-year-old child, said Lauren Jonas, OpenAI's head of youth well-being. Parents can also set specific hours that their kids can't use ChatGPT. Another option prevents teens' ChatGPT conversations from being used to train OpenAI models. Kids can't turn off any of the settings that parents turn on. Default protections. For teens who agree to the parental controls, the restricted content experience would be on by default. That means sensitive content such as viral challenges, extreme beauty ideals, and sexual, romantic, or violent role play won't show up in ChatGPT's answers. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Michelle with the Wall Street Journal. I hope you've enjoyed today's readings from the audio reading service at Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.